So if you were here last week, you'll know that I'd mentioned that we were finishing one series called Culture Shift, where we explored the values of the church, and that this week we're beginning a new series called This Is Us. I can't lay claim to originality when it comes to the series title. We started watching something on Netflix or Amazon Prime, and we didn't actually make it very far, but it was a series about a family of triplets called This Is Us, and I gave up the ghost in the end, but I like the title. And if you hang around this church long enough, you will hear on a reasonably regular basis that the phrase, anything is possible. Anything is possible, and you will see it in our literature. You'll read about it on the blog, on the website. You'll hear it in messages. I want you to know that it's not a motivational mantra that helps us sort of get a couple of extra reps out if we're doing bench presses or something like that. It's not sort of the power of positive thinking or some sort of self-help talk type thing. Okay, it is actually what I would want to say is a paradigm shift. It is a way of seeing the world, that we believe that God is limitless in his love for us here at Encounter, that we believe that he is limitless in his power, and he's limitless in what it is he wants to do in and through our lives here, that he is involved in a limitless way in the intimate details of our lives. We are known this morning deeply and intimately. There's nothing that he doesn't know about that. And you may be saying to yourself, that sounds great, Mark, but I'm not sure that I really, really believe like that. And if that is you, we also say on a regular basis, everyone's welcome here. And we want you to know that you are welcome no matter what you believe. You are welcome here. And if you don't have faith like that, then you can borrow from somebody else here. Because we need to borrow each other's faith from time. I really, really, I put my hands up regularly and say, I need to borrow somebody else's faith from time to time, because, life is a bit of a challenge, isn't it? Who finds life a challenge from time to time? It is, okay, especially when it's raining. And, so you can borrow our faith, and we do want this. Over the years, the history of this church is that those that have led it over the years and served you have wanted this to be a safe place where people can journey in pilgrimage, as it were, and process the things of God. And when we use that phrase, anything's possible, I also need to put up a little bit of a disclaimer as well. We didn't come up with that phrase either. All right, just in case you thought, oh, where did Mark get that from? I found it in the Bible. I plagiarized Jesus, all right. So therefore, I can't copyright it, but I'm going to say it a lot because Jesus said it, I'm going to say it a lot, okay? But it is what we're going to unpack in between now and all the way up to Advent. We're going to have a little special season in Advent, which is one of the most beautiful seasons in the life of the church, where we're going to celebrate the light breaking out and coming to us as men and women. But we're going to unpack this phrase, okay, because several times in the Gospels, Jesus teaches us that anything is possible. So if you've got a Bible, and I only say that because I like to hear the sound of Bibles rustling, really, but the words are going to appear on the screens as well for you. But there's just something about pages rustling. Actually, if you've got a Bible, turn to Matthew. Is it Matthew or Mark 19? Matthew 19. Okay, Matthew 19. Okay, sorry, I don't need that. I've already written it. So let me just give you a little bit of context here, okay? Jesus is having a conversation with the disciples after an interaction with the rich young ruler, which is a great message in itself, because you could have 3 points, couldn't you, about the rich young ruler? He was rich, he was young, and he was a ruler. But Jesus looked at them and he said, with man, verse 28, with man this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. And essentially what Jesus is saying is that impossibility is not in God's vocabulary. Nothing is impossible for God. And one of the things we were chatting during the week that I noticed, I was just going somewhere, and I said, Karen, you've got to write this down for me. Okay? We are not going to allow our inferior earthly experience shape what is theologically true that we get from the New Testament about Jesus and the way that he calls us to live our lives. Nothing is impossible for God. And what that means is that there is no situation in our lives that is too dire. There is no circumstance that is too bleak. There is no debt that is too overwhelming. There is no diagnosis that is too awful. There is no heartbreak that is too broken. There is no relationship that is too estranged. Nothing is impossible for God. And so when we say anything's possible, we take it back to Jesus. And this is what Jesus taught us on many occasions. There's a if you flip over over to Mark 9, there's a conversation in Mark 9 where Jesus is having a conversation with a chap whose son is ill. And this man comes to Jesus because his son has been having convulsions, and the convulsions are so bad it nearly throws the son into the fire and it nearly kills the son. So the father is desperate, and Jesus is coming to town, and he's heard about Jesus. So he takes his son to Jesus, and he pleads with Jesus, "If you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." And it's worth noting that he says, "If you can." In other words, if you're capable, if you have the capacity, Jesus, if you are able and if you are willing, would you do something here? And Jesus picks up on that word. He always does that, doesn't he? Picks up on the little things. It's so frustrating sometimes, especially if you're not a detailed person like me. He picks up on the little things, and he picks up on this word if, and he says, "If you can," says Jesus, "everything is possible for the one who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." I really love that. We talk about this being an authentic place, don't we? We talk about this being a real place. I try to be as real as I possibly can with you, okay? You've got this father who comes to Jesus with a mixture of faith and doubt. There's this mixture of belief and unbelief, this mixture of worry and prayer. And he's saying, "I do believe, Jesus, but I've got this unbelief going on inside of me." Anyone ever been there? Just the three of us. Okay. I get where he's coming from. I really, really understand this when he comes to Jesus like this. And when you read the text, we discover how Jesus responds. Jesus says, "Well, you've got unbelief. You've got doubt. You just need to go off now and work on your theology and sort the whole thing out, okay? Figure it out and come back to me when you've got no doubt." Which is not what he says at all. Jesus tells the man who says, "Help me. I'm desperate. Please help me again. Help my unbelief." In that moment, Jesus goes right over to the man's son and he heals the man's son. And that boy's life was never the same. And that boy would have grown up to tell his grandchildren, who would have told their children about this person called Jesus. And I think about the faith of that father. I believe, but help my unbelief. And that is where many of us are a lot of the time. But I want you to see this, that the father had enough faith. Do you know how much enough faith is? It's enough faith to come to Jesus. Enough faith to come to Jesus. If you've got enough faith to come to Jesus, that is enough faith. And some of us say, "I need a little bit more faith." Coming to Jesus is enough faith. Jesus says, "I can work with that. That's enough. Come to me. That's enough," okay? Jesus is enough for us. He is always enough for us. And you may read this story, you may hear me talking about this story, and you may, I don't know. I'm not really sure whether that really, really happened, or I'm not really sure whether sort of miracles still happen sort of today. It might have happened back then, but I'm not sure what happens now. And, what if miracles are just what we call coincidences? Maybe they just make us feel better about our faith. And I was going to share one story at this moment that I heard a week ago, and that story disappeared off Facebook. And Karen told me that that's because the Lord didn't want me to tell that story. So I'm not going to tell that story. And I asked him, what story am I meant to tell? And he said, wait. And I've been waiting this morning. And it's just reminded me of something. A number of years ago, you may know, most of you will know, that we used to help lead a movement and we used to run a summer conference for many people. And there were many, many venues on this site in the Bath and West Showground. One of the venues was called Venue 2, but we spent most of our time in what was called the main arena. And one day after a session, a morning session, I was back in what was called the leaders' lounge, and somebody came up to me and said, I've got to tell you something that happened to me. And this young man is a man of great credibility. He's a very bright cookie, all right, who was a curate at the time in the Church of England, and he wasn't used to this sort of thing particularly happening. But he'd been in a session in Venue 2 where Alan Scott, you might have heard of that name, was speaking. And Alan was the leader of what was then Causeway Coast Vineyard, where there's been a great sort of outpouring of the Spirit, and now he's leading Anaheim Vineyard, where John Wimber sort of started the vineyard movement, essentially. And Alan Scott had been speaking like this, and suddenly, halfway through his talk, he felt the Lord nudging him, which is really inconvenient when you're a speaker and you've put a lot of effort into preparing what you're going to do. But the Lord nudged him to stop, and he had this sense that he was meant to pray for anybody that had arthritic conditions or had knee replacements or hip replacements or was in terrible sort of arthritic pain. And this young chap, who was wearing shorts and sort of welly boots up to here, was a young man who had had, as a young man, a double knee replacement sort of op. So he had false knees in both his knees and huge scars from here down to there, the top of his knees down to the bottom, halfway down his shin. And he came into this lounge and told me what had happened, that Alan had stopped his talk and said, I think we need to pray for people that have this condition. And this young man had a friend with him who nudged him out into the aisle and told him to go down to the front. That I think we all need friends like that. Because sometimes who's slow to lean in occasionally? Who thinks they've missed the boat from time to time with what the Lord was doing? Yeah. So he didn't have any choice. He was shoved out, and he went down to the front, and he was prayed for along with many, many people, and he felt an easing of the pain that he had. And he came back to his seat after a while, and as he was in his seat, his mate looked down at his legs and said, didn't you have two scars on the front of your leg before you went up for prayer? And he said, yeah. And he looked down, and the knees were scar-free. And I was like, wow. So his mate said, I think you ought to go back and tell everybody and encourage them. And so he didn't really want to do that, but he was shoved up again. And up he went, and he shared this sort of testimony of the scars disappearing. And he was prayed for again, and he sensed God touching him powerfully. And after that, he came into the lounge, and the leader's lounge, and he told me this story. And as he was talking to me, I had this sense that I said to him, I really, really think when you get home, you ought to go and see the medics and see what might have happened. Long story short, he has two sets of x-rays. One pre-being prayed for and one post-being prayed for. The pre-ones have artificial knee joints in, and the post-ones have no artificial knee joints in at all. And he has perfect movement in his knees and free of pain. Now, don't ask me to explain that completely, but it's a miracle. It's a miracle. And God never ceases to amaze me because we can't put him in a box. And you may be going, I'm not sure I really believe that, Mark. Maybe that's just a coincidence. Reminds me of the great William Temple quote, okay, when I pray, coincidences happen. And when I stop praying, coincidences stop happening. You can call it a coincidence. You can call it a miracle. Jesus says, anything's possible. Maybe we're like the dad, I believe and I've got this unbelief. We are all there, as I've said at different times. But miracles do happen. With God, anything is possible.
heard another story a couple of weeks ago. I just read it somewhere about a couple that wanted to get married, which was lovely. But they had been separated for 22 months and divorced for 13 months. And they said that God had worked a miracle in their lives individually, that they'd come back together again and they wanted to be remarried. And I noted that the chap said it was cheaper the second time round. They just went for a Chinese meal afterwards, which I thought was rather sweet. It's possible. Anything's possible. God still works miracles. And when we survey the landscape of our lives, I wonder where we need to believe again, individually and corporately as a church family. You know, is it in a relationship that's sort of gone sideways a little bit, or a child that might have lost their way and we're just broken by the direction they're heading in, or we're looking for a job that's more meaningful and more satisfying, or we're looking for a place to live, or we're just trying to find some significance and purpose and meaning in life. Maybe it's the health situation for us or somebody that we love. Where do we need to believe again that anything's possible? Maybe our honest prayer today is, I believe, but would you help me with my unbelief? And we see from the story that that's where the miracle begins. You know, there was enough faith just to glance towards and turn towards Jesus. Maybe you're here this morning, you're not even sure whether you believe in God. You know, maybe you've been dragged along here this morning and just told that they'd take you for a drink in the line afterwards, and you're just thinking about whether you're going to have a lager or a bitter, I don't know. I want you to know, it doesn't matter where we are, we do not have to have this whole faith thing figured out on our spiritual journey. We don't. To be part of this series or to be part of this church, we really don't. And if I'm really being honest, I've never met anyone who's got this whole faith thing figured out. I've never met anybody. You know, God is more majestic, he's more mysterious, he's more beautiful than we could ever imagine. His love has no limit. We can't comprehend his ways. His ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are greater than our thoughts. And anyone who tells you they've got God all figured out, I would be deeply suspicious of them, really. I'd want to love them, but I just want to question their version of God. You know, we cannot comprehend the vastness of God. But although we can't comprehend the fullness or the vastness of God, God wants to be known by us. That's why he's given us his word. That's why he's created the church, so that we can grow and we can learn together. That's why he's given us his son, who is the ultimate revelation of the Father. That's why he gives us his presence through his spirit in this moment, that we would come to know him and that we would be known by him intimately and personally. Because Jesus says, if you have seen me, you've seen the Father. You want to know what God looks like? Look at Jesus. Jesus is, quote one of my favorite phrases of the last 3.5 years, Jesus is perfect theology. He is perfect theology. And that's why in this series, we're going to be looking, essentially me, I'm going to be looking at the miracles of Jesus in the life of Jesus. And as we read the Gospels, we see all these interactions that Jesus has, you know, and they will teach us about faith. They will teach us, they will help us to grow in this idea, this concept, this understanding that anything is possible. So we're going to be looking at the miracles in John's Gospel, where they're not actually called miracles, but they're actually called signs. And signs are symbols that always point to a greater reality. So these signs in John's Gospel that we're going to be looking at over this sort of mini-series are not just events in themselves. They teach us about something. They communicate something to us about who Jesus is and how we should see him and how he sees us. They're signs and they're symbols. Now, a little while ago, I just sort of went off on a little sidetrack in life, and I sort of got interested in the whole world of advertising and marketing, and I'm not going to bore you with all of that, okay? But one of the things I became moderately interested in was the whole world of logos. And one of my favorites is the FedEx logo. So can you see that? That's nice and big and bold, isn't it? Now, the reason I love this is because there is a symbol hidden inside the FedEx. How many of you, just without shouting, how many of you can see the symbol? Just raise your hands. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. How many of you can't see the symbol? How many put your hands up so you could see it because you just didn't want to be found out? For those of you that can't see it, can you see it here? It's between the E and the X is an arrow. Oh, that was a lot more voices that said, all right, than put their hands up. Okay, it's a symbol that FedEx are moving forward. See, it suggests something. And now you've seen it, you're going to become preachers of the FedEx message, aren't you? You're going to proclaim the gospel of FedEx everywhere you go, okay? You're going to be pointing that to everyone. Listen, the miracles in the Gospel of John, okay, they are signs, they are wonders that point to a greater reality. Inside the word, inside Jesus, okay, inside the stories, we find symbols that point us to greater truth about who he is. So I want to look at, just briefly, having set the series up, I just want to look at John chapter 2. If you want to go there, that would be helpful, and so that we might see him better and understand how he sees us. John 2 is the miracle at the wedding of Cana. So verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding. It took place at Cana in Galilee, and Jesus' mother was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why are you telling me this?" Jesus replied. "The time for me to show who I really am isn't here yet." And his mother said to the servants, "Do what he tells you." 6 stone water jars stood nearby. The Jews used water from that kind of jar for special washing. They did not make themselves pure, they did that to make themselves pure and clean. Each jar could hold 20 to 30 gallons. And Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," so they filled them to the top. Then he told them, "Now dip some out, take it to the person in charge of the dinner." And they did what he said. The person in charge tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He didn't realize where it had come from. But the servants who had brought the water knew. Then the person in charge called the groom to one side. He said to him, "Everyone brings out the best wine first, but they bring out the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best until now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of his signs. Jesus showed his glory by doing this sign, and his disciples believed in him. Excuse me. That's wine. Now, I know that Furnace have got a big wedding coming up soon, but at every wedding, something's going to go wrong. No jumping over rivers before this one. Someone's going to forget where to stand. Someone's going to forget a line, okay? It's not going to be as bad as 4 weddings and a funeral, necessarily. You're going to forget the rings, but something's going to go wrong. What happened here was that they ran out of wine. And this is not only a logistical problem, of course, but it is socially catastrophic, okay? Because wine was the most important part of the reception, the party. We lived in the Middle East for a year. We met out there. And a wedding happened all over the weekend. It was incredible. It would just go on. And so, you know, running out of wine was a big thing. It was massive, okay? It's a disgrace. And in what was a shame culture, great shame would be attached to this. And it was the bridegroom's responsibility to make sure that there was enough wine there. So it was a horrible, horrible way to start married life off. And Mary appears to be the first person, it often is the women, really, appears to be the first person to realize what's going on here, actually. And she just says 5 words: "They have no more wine." Max Lucado, the author, says, "This is the first prayer prayed to Jesus in the Gospels. They have no more wine." That's not the sort of prayer or slogan you'd find in a Christian bookstore on a plaque being sold to go up in your hallway: "They have no more wine." But she sees the problem, she comes to Jesus with a sincere prayer here. And I think sometimes we carry this pressure in prayer that we've got to have all the right words, you know, as it were. We've got to have the religious vernacular or the religious kalanetics in the way that we talk. We've got to use them so that we can get God's attention. But she just gets Jesus' attention with a desperate, sincere, and honest prayer. You see, it is not the power of the words that we use when we pray. It's the one to whom we are praying where the power is. So she says, we have no more wine. And I think what Mary teaches us is this, okay, that prayer is not a last resort. It is a first response. Prayer is a first response, not a last resort. And I do think, actually, that many of us grew up, and not necessarily through any fault of our own, but we grew up in an environment or a world where we were taught, just try everything you can. If that doesn't work, then pray. I think honestly, you know, but with Mary, we see that it's her first response here. You know, she sees the problem. Her first response is prayer. And she turns to Jesus, but I think his response is really sort of interesting. He basically says, my hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come. And when Jesus talks about his hour, he's talking about his crucifixion here. So he's saying, Mary, Mum, do you realize that when we set this thing in motion, it ends with me on the cross? It ends with me laying down my life. Eventually, yes, my resurrection, but it ends with me laying down my life. And I find it really interesting that in John's Gospel, that the two times we find Mary in John's Gospel is here at the wedding at Cana of Galilee and at the foot of the cross with the crucifixion. And she just doesn't understand the fullness of that phrase in this moment. But she just keeps pressing on anyway. She keeps believing that Jesus can do something. So she sees the problem, she turns to Jesus, and then she turns to the servants and says, just do whatever he tells you to. I love it. I really love that. And if you're taking notes, because one or two of you do, here is the big idea for today, okay? Is anything is possible when you see the problem and you turn to Jesus and then you do whatever he tells you to do. That's a big idea. And I find it really interesting that Jesus was adaptable here. Jesus adjusted his plans. And when you read through the Gospels, and I may have got this wrong, so I'm very open to being corrected on this, okay? But I don't ever see Jesus with a miracle on his calendar. I don't see it, actually. You know, it's in the plans of the Father, and Jesus says, I only do what I see the Father sort of doing. But it's always disguised as an interruption. And I think miracles, it was for Alan Scott when he was speaking, disguised as an interruption. And I do wonder sometimes whether I mean, probably not true for you, but whether I've missed out on miracles daily because I'm in such a hurry and I don't want to mess up my schedule. I don't know. Sometimes the most loving thing we can do is to adjust our plans for someone else, in the face of someone else. And when we put our plans above people, I think we can miss out on God-ordained opportunities to do something that might be considered impossible. I really do. So Jesus adjusts his plans, okay? He tells the servants, you know, take these ritual cleansing jars, the six of them, fill them to the water. So they take the jars, they hold 20 to 30 gallons each. They fill them up, okay, with water. And, you know, I find it interesting that as they were filled up, they would have weighed in excess of 250 pounds filled with water. So it says, fill them to the top, fill them to the brim, as it were. And you know, and the more filled to the brim they are, the harder it is to move them around. So there's some inconvenience involved here. And sometimes, you know, how many of us want to see God do a miracle? But the truth is that most of us don't want to be inconvenienced. We don't like being, we want to see God move, but we're not so sure we want to be moved ourselves, as it were. So I actually think, for instance, in the culture of this church, it takes faith sometimes to be prayed for. That young man that I talked to you about, in the end, he had to walk to the front, or he had to stand up. He had to allow himself to be prayed for, and we have to be inconvenienced sometimes to turn the car around and go back and say sorry. We're inconvenienced from time to time to go to a counselor and ask for help or to check into rehab and get some help, you know. or to apply for another job that might be more meaningful or significant. It's often through the next thing that we find ourselves in the moment, where God wants to invade the impossible. But it requires us filling it to the brim. You know, we want God to do the things that only he can do, but it requires us to do the things that he asks us to do, I think. What could the servants do? They could fill the jars to the brim. I love the detail of that. Really, it's there, you know. They're basically saying, we're not going to be half-hearted about this. We're not going to be half-hearted, you know. I can think of people in this room at this very moment who've traveled to the other side of the world because they're so desperate for the presence of God. They put their hands in their pocket. They've flown to California. God seems to do more things in California than he does elsewhere, I know. But they've gone there because they're hungry, or Canada, or wherever. They've gone there because they're giving it everything they can for the sake of encountering God. I believe that this is trust here. What we're seeing is trust on the part of the servants, okay? It was faith for them to fill the jars. It was them exercising faithfulness. And I think this combination of faith and faithfulness, you know, put them in a position to experience the miraculous and for Jesus to do what only Jesus could do in the end. How many of you drink your coffee black here? How many of you like milk or cream in your coffee? Just, okay. Now, you need to know, those of you that have milk or cream in your coffee, that those of us who drink our coffee black, we think we're a better breed. We think we're a better species. But we're not. I know that we're not, but there is that sort of snobbery there. And when you have black coffee and you go to a coffee shop and you stand in front of the barista and they say, would you like some milk with your coffee? And you say no. In that moment, do you know what you want the barista to do? You want them to fill that coffee cup up full of coffee. You don't want any space for milk. They always leave it. Karen always asks for a little extra hot water, which I think is a really good idea. Okay, you just want it filled to the brim. God is looking for people that will fill it to the brim. He really is. When we go to work, that we'll fill it to the brim. When we get home with our spouse or with our children, that we fill it to the brim in our friendships, that we fill it to the brim as we do community life together, that we would fill it to the brim. That sometimes we might turn our iPhones off and just not be distracted. So we spend time with the people that we love and love us. I don't know what it looks like for you, what it means to step back and say, how can I fill it to the brim in my life? How can I fill it to the brim in my relationships? How can I fill it to the brim in my family or what matters most? You see, the difference between an average life and an abundant life, I think, is just filling it to the brim. I really do. The difference between, this is a bit cheesy, I heard it years ago, the difference between extraordinary and ordinary is just a little bit extra. But it's true. Okay, we just need to be people that are prepared to give a bit more, do a little bit extra from time to time, fill it to the brim. So Jesus says, go and take some water out and take it to the master of the banquet. And I just love this idea of them walking along with a pitcher of basically water that they wash their faces and hands and feet in or something like that. You know, imagine taking this to your boss and saying, here, have some wine. It's like, you know, imagine the faith involved in this. I mean, it's really incredible. They were just willing to look stupid in that moment. And it does require a willingness to look stupid from time to time, okay? Actually, do you know, I spent years trying to make Christianity appear to be cool. There's nothing cool about Christianity. There's nothing cool about it. We look stupid most of the time. We've become foolish. We are foolishness to the Greeks. We are, okay, really. So they give their boss a pitcher, okay? So I just imagine this moment, you know, am I going to lose my job? Is my head going to get chopped off? You know, whatever, you know. And he tries it, and this is incredible. This is, what cellar did you get this from? This is the finest. I know I talked about wine last week, so I don't want to carry it away and be on too much of a roll with this. But, you know, the truth is that Jesus doesn't make average wine. Thank you, Jesus. He doesn't want to make our lives average either. Gosh, it's migration time already. Do you know, he wants to fill our lives to the brim and make our lives extraordinary. And the truth is, it's not just, because I've heard this before from sometime, it's not just about the quality here. What Jesus wants is quality, not quantity. This is quality and quantity here. He brings abundance. That's who he is. That's what he does. So he turns the water into wine, and John says, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of his signs. And Jesus showed his glory by doing this sign, and his disciples believed in him. This sign revealed his glory. And the disciples saw this greater reality, and it all pointed to who he was and what it was that he'd come to do and was going to do. This miracle is a message. This sign is a symbol. And here's, with this I close, what Jesus came to teach us. He stepped into this wedding environment where there was all this shame and all this disappointment and all this emptiness. And he takes the shame upon himself and he provides the finest of wine. It was the groom's responsibility. But Jesus steps in as the true bridegroom. The Bible tells us that as a church, we are the bride and he is the bridegroom. And as the bridegroom, Jesus provides the wine that was and still does, the wine that is needed. Jesus steps in as the true master of the feast. He steps in with his presence and with his provision, and he keeps the party going. Jesus basically has come to say that I've come to bring heaven's reality to earth. I've come to make what lies ahead of us in the future real in the here and the now. The kingdom has come in me. I've come that you could experience the presence and the power and the peace and the purity and the party of God. That you would know that joy. He comes to restore joy. Joy. He comes to restore joy to the brokenhearted. He comes to restore joy to lives. He comes to take our shame and to bring us freedom and wholeness. That is who he is. And that is what he does. He comes to teach us here at Encounter that with him, anything is possible. Amen. Amen. Let's just be still. Let's be quiet for a moment.